he began talking about what are the conditions under which determination flourishes. What helps determination? I think there were a couple of questions in this regard. What keeps determination going? What produces the enthusiasm? Because if you remember, he was discussing the example of Jad Bharata and how at the end, when he became attached to the deer and had to come back another lifetime and so forth, that just made him all the more determined to progress on the spiritual path. That little setback, that little fall down. And yet, sometimes for us, it may feel like when the setback happens in Krishna consciousness or the fall down, that instead of increasing our determination to get up and do better, we become disheartened and feel that it's all pointless and we're never going to get there. Right? So, in other words, a fall down could lead to more determination, but it could also lead to disheartening, that we feel that we're a failure. So what's the difference? How do we get it to that point of actually making it, setbacks a pillar for the production of more determination? And the key to that lies in one of the most important themes of the Nectar of Instruction, which is the importance of association of devotees. If you notice, in verse after verse, Rupa Goswami mentions this point again and again. So in the six things that are unfavorable for devotional service, he says, jana sangash chalolyam cha. He says, association of non-devotees is one of the six things that will destroy one's progress on bhakti. Then in the positive verse about the six things that increase devotion, he says, sangatyagat satovritte. Giving up the association, material association, and sato vritte, following in the footsteps of great souls. Okay, so he kind of repeats the same thing over the two verses. In the negative verse, he says, "Oh, association with non-devotees is bad." In the positive verse, he says, "Giving up the association with non-devotees is good." So it's kind of the same thing put twice, which gives us a clue that it's a very important thing when an author repeats himself several times. Not only does he do it twice, but then in the next verse, he describes or defines what association consists of. Six types of loving exchanges. Dadati pratigrinati, buhyam akhyati pricchati, bhunte bhojayate chaiva, shadvidham priti lakshanam. The six symptoms of love in a relationship. Giving and receiving gifts. Dadati pratigrihnati, these are two. Guhyam akhyati pricchati, inquiring about someone else, their welfare, in confidence, and hearing what they have to say in confidence. And accepting prasad and receiving prasad from them, giving and offering food. Okay. So he describes what that association consists of. Then he goes on in the next verse to define the different types of association that we can find at different kinds of calibers of devotees. Finally, he describes the nature of the pure devotee so that we might seek out his or her association and service and endeavor to serve them. So association repeatedly comes up over a large chunk of the Nectar of Instruction. Remember what we've talked about at the beginning of the seminar, that if the Nectar of Instruction is in fact the essence of all advice, and if you've got in fact 11 verses to cover the entire range of Vedic wisdom and the path back to Godhead, then spending more than one verse on any topic is going to be quite significant of a choice. But to mention the same thing in four different verses, that means that this is very, very important. It's very significant. So just by the proportion of the amount of time he spends on it and the number of times he mentions it, it should give us a clue as to the importance of association devotees. There's that famous verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita, of course, which says, sadhu sanga, sarva shastra koi, lava matra sadhu sanga, sarva siddhi hoy. That association with sadhus, association with devotees, association with devotees. By a moment's association with devotees, sharva shuddhi hoy, all perfection is achieved, just by one moment. And this is in fact basically a Bengali version of a similar statement said in Srimad Bhagavatam, in which it says, tulayama labenapi, that merely a moment's association, lava, with a pure devotee cannot be compared to any other gift that you find in this world, when even the kingdom of heaven itself would not stand a chance in front of a moment's association with a devotee. Lava matra. So lava is I forget the exact calculation, but it's like 1/14th of a second or something like that. So it's not even a moment. It's like the blinking of an eye, which is much less than a second. So the power of association cannot be overemphasized. As Gopal was saying, that we will be defined by the association that we keep. There's a famous statement. I forget who said it. Let me look it up here. Yeah. And this is actually from the Bible. It's from Proverbs. It says, a mirror reflects a man's face, but what he is really like is shown by the kinds of friends he chooses. So we look in the mirror and we think, oh, I look nice. But in fact, the mirror will tell us very little about who we are. A much better judge of a person is the type of company they keep, because that company will define them. One time, I was with Lokanath Maharaj when he was... we were spending a little bit of time together to work on this Sanskrit pronunciation book that he recently came out with. Some of you may have seen it. It's a guide to Sanskrit pronunciation for devotees. This is several years ago when he was working on the book, and he wanted me to help in some ways for the book. So we were on a little retreat in a place called Alibag, which is near Bombay. It was a coastal area, and the house the devotees had rented from it was just a small little hut, was right along the sea. And as our week there concluded, we were taking an evening walk down the beach. Very beautiful. The moon was already up, and it was shimmering on the sand and on the sea. And Maharaj was in a very kind, very giving mood. It was kind of the end of our stay there. So he said, Radhikraman, you have any questions, anything you want to ask? So I said, Maharaj, well, nothing in particular, but I'm just getting started on my spiritual life, on my Krishna consciousness. And you have so much experience and so much advancement. If there's one piece of advice that you could give me, just one thing that I could take to heart, what would that be? And Maharaj thought for a moment and said, he asked me, have you ever been to a Kumbh Mela? And I said, no, I've never been to a Kumbh Mela. He said, well, if you go to a Kumbh Mela and you endeavor to take a bath during the appropriate time when everyone's supposed to take a bath, and you find yourself in the middle of that crowd, he said, even if when that time arrives, right, to take a bath, even if you don't want to take a bath in the Ganga, the crowd is so tightly packed up that literally you will be carried and picked up and dumped in the middle of the Ganga. Right? Someone who's determined to turn around and walk the other way. Oh, suppose you freak out, you panic at the end. Oh, I can't do this. What if I drown? There's too many people and you have a panic attack. And so you say, I'm going to head the other direction. It's impossible. Right? You can resist, but the pressure of the crowd is so great that you'll be picked up and you'll be plopped right in the middle of the Ganga at the right time, and you'll get the benefit of Kumbh Mela. That's none. And so he said, that is what we have to do in our devotional life, in our Krishna consciousness. If we can just remain packed up in the association of devotees, this is Prabhupada's beautiful phrase, right? Just remain packed up together in Krishna consciousness. If we, he said, try to place yourself so thickly in the association of devotees that even if for some reason at some point in life you decide, I don't actually want to be a devotee, or I want to take it a little slower, or whatever, it won't make a difference. All your friends will be devotees, your social life, your kids are devotees by now, and it's too late. You're already in the middle of the crowd. And just like that beautiful line that Gopal was quoting from this purport here, Prabhupada's Nectar of Instruction purport, where he said, what was the line? Inevitable, or what did he say? Inescapable?
Once you start devotional service, we're inevitably dragged.
Yeah,
to success.
To success. Once we start devotional service, we are inevitably dragged to success. And so this is the point, might say, just do that somehow. And it's actually a fact, right? There will be times that are better and worse in our devotional practice, no matter how hard we try. There will be ups and downs. Things will happen. But the thing that carries us through the downs and still makes it an overall trajectory of up is if we keep ourselves packed up in the association of devotees. What will make that fall down a reason for increased determination rather than disheartening is the fact that we will find ourselves, that we are in the middle of the association of devotees. That's the key factor there. And this is why Rupa Goswami is emphasizing this point over and over again. He's associated with devotees, associated with devotees, associated with devotees. I learned this in my own life. The first time I had to live on my own, away from... in early years of life, we were in Boise, Idaho, growing up in basically a temple atmosphere, and my parents were running a temple out of our home. And so there was a lot of association, a lot of support. Before we left home for the first time to study in England, my parents made sure that we had the shelter of a spiritual master and that kind of guidance. And then in Oxford, we were fortunate to be in a community of devotees there studying all together. My first job at the University of Florida was right near to where the Krishna lunch program happens, and living right next to the temple and being able to go for morning program every day. But my first permanent job, the first time I had a real job in the world, it was in Center College in Kentucky. And where I was located, it was kind of the center of a big blind spot for devotee association in the United States. Literally, I had to drive 4 hours in any direction I chose. It was a minimum of 4 hours to encounter any devotees, and up to 6 hours to find a temple. So very, very, just out in the middle of nowhere. And it was such a struggle to keep up Krishna consciousness, spiritual life. Up to that point, I was thinking, oh, it's not so difficult, it's not so easy, it's not so bad. You know? I wonder why it's why it's sometimes such a struggle, but it's not so bad. But when the first time I had to go it alone, stay there on my own, it was difficult. It was difficult. Such a struggle because, to put it in material terms, there's no social pressure. Right? No one knows what time you wake up in the morning. Right? No one knows what you're eating. No one knows anything. And so everything is, you kind of see what you're really made of, and what your spiritual life is really made of. How much of it is substance, and how much of it is just a shell, and just the outside. And it was an eye-opening experience. Because I realized, wow, the association of devotees is not just a bonus for quicker advancement in Krishna consciousness. It's not just an extra perk that makes things easier. The association of devotees is what spiritual life is actually made of. That's what it is. Sometimes we feel, oh, you know, at this time I become weak. When I'm alone, I become weak. But I'm, you know, in the temple, I'm stronger. No, the fact of the matter is we're actually always weak. Right? That's the nature of the living entity, the marginal energy, is that we're always weak. We're always prone to be swept away by the Lord's maya. That's our nature. So it's not like, oh, I was strong last year, but this year I've become weak. No, we're always weak. The difference is just, when were you in the association of devotees, and when are you not? That's all. Because it's actually the association of devotees that provides substance to our Krishna consciousness. That's what we're made of, is the mercy, the blessings, and the association of devotees. That's what fills that shell with real bhakti. Otherwise, it very much is a shell only. So then at that point I realized, okay, if I want to keep up this career, I better get married. find some association, right? Get married and then create your own association. And it's a big support, it's a big help. We were talking about this earlier, how vows protect us, right? So it's okay. But that continues, right? When we find ourselves in the thick of association, Krishna consciousness becomes so much easier. We even feel like we're natural devotees. We have some feeling for Krishna. And it comes up, and then we're out of that association, we sink back down again. So association is crucial. It's very important. And here, Rupa Goswami, he defines what association consists of. He gives us two instructions. Associate with devotees, and avoid the association of non-devotees. Now, one could say, well, yeah, in principle that's nice, but I'm a working man in this world, I've got things to do, or I'm a student, I go to university. How am I supposed to avoid the association of non-devotees? How can I do this and be still be practical? Should I just ignore everyone I meet? Should I be rude to them? Or should I choose a job in which I won't have any human interaction? What's my future if I cannot associate? No. Yeah, association has to be understood also. It has to be defined. What association is. Suppose there's a little ant crawling on the ground there, right next to Ramachandra Prabhu. So is Ramachandra Prabhu associating with the ant? Is the ant associating with Ramachandra Prabhu? No. I mean, the ant may get some spiritual benefit, but he's not actually associating. There's no endeavor on either one of their parts to associate. A fly can sit on an elephant, but it doesn't make the fly any greater. Because there's no association going on there. The fly still stays a fly, and the elephant stays an elephant. When the king gets up on the elephant, then that does something, right? It makes the king's position so much more visible, so much stronger. The king is associating with the elephant, but the fly is not. It's just a happenstance, it's a coincidence. So just because you find yourself in contact or in proximity with someone is not what association is. Association he defines basically as three types of exchanges, six activities come in pairs that are exchanged between each other. Dadati pratigrihnati, giving and receiving gifts. Just think of what we do with our families. Just think of what we do during holiday season. Just think of what we do during birthdays. In each one of these situations, we find ourselves exchanging gifts, giving something, receiving something. That kind of exchange, Rupa Goswami says, is association. Revealing one's mind in confidence to someone and asking what they have to say in confidence. This is a very powerful form of association. Who do you reveal your mind to? When you're having a down day or you're having an up day, you want to tell someone what's going on in your life, who do you go to? Someone we trust, right? And who are those people? Are they devotees? Are they non-devotees? That's the question. Or not just devotees, non-devotees, that's a black and white distinction, but the quality, even, of that association. Because in each one, you can have different degrees or qualities of association. We'll talk more about that in a minute. And finally, the food we share. A very, very powerful thing. Because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu makes very clear that the consciousness of a person is invested in the food they prepare. So, just for example, if you're at an art gallery and you see a work of art, suppose it's a very beautiful scene of spring, rivers and mountains, and nice natural phenomena. Then by seeing that, what's going to happen? You're going to start feeling that those positive qualities, those positive feelings, right, of freshness and light and so forth. And suppose you see a painting which is very disturbing, very depressing, where the colors are very jarring, or the shapes. It immediately, what happens? You go into a different state of mind. In other words, the consciousness of the painter at the time he or she created that painting enters into whoever sees that painting, whoever partakes of it. The same goes with food. The consciousness of the creator is a creative activity. This is true of any creative activity. A musician, their consciousness will enter. This is why people say, if you listen to Bach and Mozart, then your kids become smarter as a result of listening to this music, or you start thinking more. Why? Because if they had certain intelligence and patterns in their music, that's going to come to you. Whatever consciousness is invested in the creation by the creator, that same consciousness we'll find ourselves when we partake of it. Food is perhaps the most powerful example of that. And yet, it's the one that people least often realize the effect that it has on individuals. What if, in an amazingly powerful way it is to associate with someone. Just like we open that box of cereal, of cornflakes, to eat in the morning with milk. Who are we associating with?
Kellogg's.
do we know? Is it that nice face of Mr. Kellogg, or is it Quaker, or who is it? A Quaker is all dead and gone. He's not making those cornflakes anymore. Kellogg's isn't. Who are we associating? We don't know. We don't know. What consciousness is invested in that box of cereal? When we have a pizza from Pizza Hut, what's the consciousness invested in that pizza? Who's making it? I'll tell you a little story. Recently, a student came to my office. He wanted some advice. Kind of for his future, graduating and so forth. And we were discussing his plans. He's graduating in May, very soon. And he was telling me, you know, even though he was just an undergraduate student, he had already worked a number of years in the restaurant industry. And his specific area was consulting to people who had a desire to start their own restaurant. He was a consultant, so he wasn't like a waiter or a chef, but he was consultant to restaurant, either people who wanted to buy franchises or start their own industry. And he said, you know, whenever someone comes to me asking about starting a restaurant, he said, the first thing I tell them is don't do it. He said, that's bad for my business, of course, because I'm a consultant for people who want to start businesses. But I tried to dissuade them from it. And I said, why? And he said, because it's the most horrible industry that I've ever encountered. After working in it, I can't imagine encouraging someone to go and work into that. He said, the chefs, and I don't know whether this is all true, but it seemed that way. I mean, he had a lot of experience working there. But he said, it's such an intense environment of competition and of passion, of trying to get every order on time to the customer, making sure the customer is pleased. These people are highly strung, very, very strong, especially the chefs. And therefore, when they get done with their night's work, 2 o'clock in the morning after everything's shut up, they're too highly strung to go back home and go to sleep. They need to calm down. So they go to a bar. And everyone else from the restaurant goes there as well. Said, most of these people, said, have the most debauched lives I've ever seen. They have all kinds of relationships, because it's a relationship of power. The chef is completely in control of the other employees, with all kinds of subordinates. They get completely drunk And naturally, a man coming home every night, late at night, completely drunk, is not going to be very good for the marriage. And so their marriages break up, and this puts them into further states of depression, that they've got very high depression, very high suicide rates, etc., etc., on and on. And then he had a whole other lecture to give about the actual conditions of cooking for the food, because in their frustration, they could care less as to what's actually going into his system. Just recently, I read an article saying that you should never upset the waiter or the people working behind it, because they can do something as simple as spitting in your pizza before putting it in the oven. How are you going to know? Right? It's all anecdotal, but the point is, it was very amazing listening to this from him, because he's not a devotee. He has no concept of this idea of consciousness going into the food, right? And yet he was unwilling to eat at any restaurant because he was concerned about the people cooking his food. Imagine for us as devotees. That what a powerful form of association that is. That consciousness of that person creating it is going into our food, we're ingesting it. And the reason it's so powerful is because how many times do you go to an art gallery? Once a year, maybe? Right? That's it, right? How many times do you see works of art other than paintings of Krishna? Rarely. How many times do we eat food? How many days of the year do we have breakfast? How many days do we eat lunch? It's every single day, several times. So in terms of getting a major dose of association, there's no better way to do it than through food. And that's why if we can purify our food and get it from the right source, the path of Krishna consciousness becomes so much easier. And if we don't do it, it's like trying to light a fire and pour water at the same time. You'll get there eventually, but it's a little illogical. It'll take a long time. So this is what Rupa Goswami defines as association. These three activities. And when they're exchanged in love amongst devotees, they become the pillar of strong Vaishnava relationships. And when they're exchanged with non-devotees, then we basically develop that kind of consciousness. We develop that kind of attitude. Excuse me. So, do we have to shut ourselves off from the world? No, by no means. We don't have to at all. But we have to be careful of who we associate with. And this is how association is defined. Who are those people who we feed and receive food from? Who we inquire from confidentially and receive? Hear what they have to say, and so on. Now, that's kind of the negative side of things. If you look at it more from a positive perspective, then these three activities are basically the pillars of any kind of relationship. And Prabhupada makes this point in the purport to that verse. He says, actually this is a fact in any relationship you want, is you have to engage in these three exchanges. And he says, the whole point of the Krishna consciousness movement, the reason we have created this society, is so devotees and non-devotees, everyone, will have an opportunity to engage in these loving exchanges with the devotees of the Lord. So that it's mutually beneficial for everyone. He says, in our temples, we hold the distribution of prasad. This benefits everyone who comes to take Krishna prasad. But he also says it benefits the devotees, both the temple and the people who come. It benefits both sides. Even the person giving is benefited, not just the person receiving. Similarly, with revealing our mind in confidence. The key word there is guhyam, our confidence. In other words, building relationships of trust. How often does it happen in a workplace, for example, that one person, you tell something that's close to you, that you're going through, to someone you think is a good friend, a buddy, and within 15 minutes, the rest of the office knows. Everyone knows. Or it happens in classrooms all the time. students spread rumors everywhere, or even in temples. No, that's not the pillar of building strong relationships. Guhyam, in secret, in confidence. Building relationships that can be trusted. One time, I was with Shachinandan Swami. This was in Radhadesh some years ago. And I asked him the same question that I asked Loknath Swami on that other visit, that Maharaj, if you can give me one piece of advice for my Krishna consciousness, what would that be? Just something to help me. And Maharaj, he gave it a good amount of thought. And he said, you know, all the devotees that I've come to respect in my Krishna conscious career, and he gave a few names, he said, and something I've tried to live my own life by, every person, every devotee, should have a few people in their lives. A few people, not a whole lot, just 3, 4, 5, from whom they can take anything, whether it be praise or it be criticism. Because they know that it's coming from the right place. It's coming from a good place. There should be a few people in our life from whom we can take anything, good or bad, praise or criticism, because we know it's coming from a genuine place. Just think about that for a moment. If someone comes and praises you, offers you some praise, how can you know that it's genuine? How can you know that that person is not trying to use you or manipulate you or flatter you in some way? Suppose I were to come up and say, oh, Harinam Ananda Prabhu, you're looking so nice today. No, really, that t-shirt really suits you well. You know, the stripes across, the green and the white, and your tilak is beautiful. Look at the wonderful smile he has, no? And you must be very intelligent. You look that type. You have a good job. You make a lot of money. How easy it is to melt someone in that way. Of course, Prabhu knows that he's smarter than to be taken in by that. I'm a little crude here, but there's ways of doing it, right? In a very nice, very subtle, very polished way. How can you know that that praise is coming from a genuine place? Perhaps I'm getting ready to ask him a favor. Right? I need something from him. Or perhaps I'm feeling guilty about something I did to him, and I'm trying to cover that up. Whatever it might be. Similarly, when someone comes to offer you some criticism, how do you know that you should take it seriously? A devotee, in his or her devotional service, will receive so many criticisms from so many fronts. Just like Srila Prabhupada himself. He was criticized by so many other people all over India for what he was doing. Today, those same people turn around and say, oh, actually, it was my idea for Prabhupada to go to the West. I'm the first one who encouraged him. Right? And record shows that they were, in fact, quite opposed to the idea, not very helpful to his followers when they came. Anyway, the point being, criticism is there, right, in any devotee's service. How do you know that you can take that criticism seriously? Of course, in a mood of humility, we should look for the learning lesson in any piece of criticism we see. But if we allow that to change our course, to change our service, for us to become disheartened, for us to give up and say, okay, obviously Krishna doesn't want me to do this, well, how do you know? Maybe he's offering you a test and saying, let's see if he can get through that criticism and still be determined. How do you know? You don't. That's the thing. We don't know, because we're not the super soul within the heart of other living beings. We can't tell where they're coming from. Sometimes we can, sometimes we can't. But there should be a few people in our lives, that was Maharaj's point, from whom we know that when this person offers me some praise, today I can give myself a pat on the back. I really did a good job. I did something nice. There's nothing wrong with that. Some sense of accomplishment in Krishna's service. Or they offer us some criticism, some correction, some guidance. Okay, this is a moment to learn. This is a time to improve. I have to, take this seriously. We should take advice from everyone, but there should be a few people who we can really take seriously, we can trust like that. That's the foundation. Guhyam akhyati prichati. Strong relationships that involve confidential revealing of one's mind and inquiring. And both sides are very important. Both sides are very important. Sometimes people, we're very fond of inquiring. But we don't want to reveal anything from ourselves because we might be too embarrassed, for example. I don't want to tell the devotee my problem because what is he going to think of me? So we might be hesitant to reveal our mind. So then the benefit we receive in return is proportionately less because we can't open ourselves up. And then similarly, if we're willing to reveal our mind, but we have no time to listen, then also we'll lose our audience very fast. And that too can happen. And we all know people who will just go on and on about themselves. And never an inquiry is made from the other direction, whether they're doing it consciously or not. But it's very difficult to maintain a relationship in that way. Because you lose your audience. This person is just... all they do is talk about themselves. And so, the mutuality of both of these is very important, is very crucial. Yes, receiving prasada, but also at some point giving prasada. It happens eventually. The receiving part in the beginning is very important. Ultimately, it turns into giving. Right? We come to the Sunday feast for years and years and years and eating the... My Guru Maharaj told this story once of a devotee who used to come to the Sunday feast and all he was interested was in the food. And they allowed him to come just for the food. So for years he came exactly in time for the prasad and had a good meal and went home. And this went on for a couple of years at least. And then there was some voice inside him that started saying, "Hey, Joe, isn't this a little like manipulative? Aren't you using them a bit? You're just like going there to eat the food, then you come back. Maybe you should go a little bit early. Sit in the last few minutes of that class or something like that." And so, okay. So he started coming a little bit early, just 15, 20, half an hour early, sat through the class and so forth. And it just made a point not to listen to anything, just sitting there waiting for the time that the prasad would be. And then, so finally, this comes from a devotee's account. I said, one day there was this voice that came up inside me and said, hey, Joe, since you're sitting here anyway, why don't you listen to what they're saying? It's like, okay, I don't have anything to lose, I guess. I'm sitting here anyway. So I said, and then one day he heard the most amazing thing in the class. The Hare Krishnas were vegetarians. He had been eating the Sunday feast all the time. The first time he went, "My God, there's no meat in this." "Oh, that's terrible. I can't be eating this." "No, I know when I'm going to eat food that doesn't have meat in it. Well, what's it? No, I don't believe in vegetarianism anyway." And of course, by that time, he was way too addicted to the prasad to stop coming. And so, okay, well, maybe there's a point. And just like that, right? Krishna, super soul there in the heart, just knocking and saying, okay, you know, prasadam has a purifying impact. It has a nice force to it. Okay, you're ready now. Wake up. You know, Krishna finds a little hole, little avenue to poke us with. And he got through, even though the defenses were so thick to keep Krishna out. But Krishna got through his belly and convinced him. Now he's a very nice devotee. We can be on the receiving end a lot. But eventually, then we want to be on the giving end too. That's it, going both ways, mutuality. So these six things, or three pairs, make for strong association. And we want to strive to make that association as far as possible with devotees. Now, there are many kinds of devotees, right? Suppose one were to say, well, okay, I should have this association of devotees, but there are so many devotees, and so many different kinds of devotees. How do I know who to associate with? Who should I be spending my time with? Which ones should I choose? How should I interact with them? Because there's so much variety in every circumstance, including in the association of devotees. And Rupa Goswami addresses that very concern in the next verse, where he talks about different kinds of devotees and how we should relate to them. And I'll just read that text for you, because he says it better than I could paraphrase. He says, one should mentally honor the devotee who chants the holy name of Krishna. One should offer humble obeisances to the devotee who has undergone spiritual initiation, diksha, and is engaged in worshipping the deity. And one should associate with and faithfully serve that pure devotee who has advanced in undeviated devotional service and whose heart is completely devoid of the propensity to criticize others. So, basically, a three-part gradation. Kanishtha Adhikari, Madhyam Adhikari, Uttam Adhikari. The Kanishtha Adhikari is defined here as chanting Krishna's holy names. And Prabhupada says in the purport, who's even received Harinam Diksha. This is someone we should always mentally honor. In other words, we should not have an offensive attitude towards anyone. Anyone at all. In fact, not even to any creature. But here we're talking about devotees specifically. Anyone who's chanting the Lord's holy name, no offensive attitude. Because in the mind we can, you know, often we're rumbling and grumbling at someone, even though outside we behave nicely and we pay our obeisances, but inside, happening, right? So even the first point, you say, oh, you're saying just mentally honor someone who's chanting Hare Krishna, that's discriminatory. No. Even mentally honoring is actually a very difficult thing to do. It's a pretty big step. That's, he says, the minimal level. The minimal level is not offering your obeisances, because that's pretty easy to do. Without the mentally honoring, to go and offer obeisances to someone, not so difficult. But in the mind, you should be honoring everyone. But then you should combine that with a physical bow, they're saying, for someone who is engaged in worshipping the deity. Basically, someone who's initiated twice more, initiated as a Brahmana, who has shown by their own life and example, demonstrated living a certain level of character in their personality. That person, we should go flat in front of. And for the pure devotee, we should associate and serve them as much as possible. We should serve them just like we serve Krishna. And who is that pure devotee? The definition is given very nicely here. I'll read the Sanskrit. Anya ninda adi shunya hridam. Anya ninda adi shunya hridam. That person whose heart, hridam, is shunya, free, empty, of anya ninda, the criticism of others, the propensity to criticize others, adi, etc., and other such offensive thoughts and mentality. Someone who has not the slightest desire to criticize anyone else, and who's completely fixed on the holy name of Krishna, that person, we should make it our life's goal to serve that person and get their association as much as possible, either through physical service or through following their instructions. Now, one could say, yeah, but this still doesn't strike me as right. Why are we still creating gradations or hierarchies? Why are we discriminating here? Why isn't the instruction just, you know, render service and bow down to everyone? Wouldn't that be easier? And the answer is, see, we sometimes think that any kind of hierarchy or any kind of inequality or any kind of distinction is automatically a negative thing. And this is part of, again, like we were talking about cultural ways of looking at things. We talked about the seeing the mind as a pressure cooker. So this is another one of those things that's so much ingrained in the way we think today, is that somehow there should be no distinction. There should be, you should not be able to see any difference at all. And everything should be exactly the same, equal. The Vedas don't agree with this for two reasons. One is, first of all, it's just not possible. It's impossible. You can say it all you want, but it's never going to happen. There's no society in the world where there's no distinctions. The question is, how do you manage those distinctions? How do you relate to people of different types, of different varieties? That's the question. Do you do it in a critical and discriminatory fashion? Or do you do it in an appropriate and welcoming and generous manner? That's the question. But if the goal is to do it in an opening and generous and welcome manner, then the very first thing we have to do is open our eyes to the existence of difference. We have to open our eyes to the reality that there are differences. And just like the Declaration of Independence in the United States says, all men are created. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and have the right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness, something like that. We hold these truths to be self-evident. In fact, the fact of the matter is that all around the world, practically no culture has held this truth to be self-evident, that everyone is created equal. Not on the level of the body. On the level of the soul, yes. And if we understand it that way, then it's a very lofty idea. But understood on a physical level, it's simply false hope. False hope, because it's never actually going to be possible. The question is, how do we relate to people of different varieties? That doesn't have to be a bad thing. It can be a very, very nice thing, actually. Just like growing up, I'm sure many of us, we have the experience of sharing dinner with the entire family in the evening. Father comes home from work, the whole family sits down together, dinner, and sharing evening dinner. I don't know if any of you have had this experience, but for myself and in many other families, there's always on the table, there's always different places for different persons. And there's always a seat that we knew, oh, this is where my father sits. And no one sat there. And there was exactly, there's no quite reason why father had to sit there or why mother had to sit there. Right? But it just happened, right? There was differences of place and different, and that was actually very nice. Someone duty was to do the dishes, someone had to, okay, mother and father finished. Then it's the children's job to pick up their plates. Why? Because there's a hierarchy there. There's a distinction there. That these are my superiors. They shouldn't have to pick up their dirty plates on their own. We do it for them. Whatever. In every family, there's different methods like that. Those can be very nice things when they're born out of love. Because they give everyone a very comfortable space to work. We know how to react. We know how to respond. We know how to relate to persons. The fact that there's a certain protocol for relating to your boss, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing, right? If you didn't know what the protocol was, like, it would be actually a great source of anxiety. You'd go into work knowing, how am I supposed to behave in front of my boss? Should I slap him on the back today, or should I shake his hands, or should I give him a jab, or should I bow before him? Right? This is the problem in going to a foreign country to do business. You don't know exactly what the process is, what the protocol is. So there's no real problem with distinctions, as long as we know how to work them nicely, how to work them properly. So when Krishna comes, returns to Dwaraka, for example, when Lord Ramachandra returns to Ayodhya, both the Bhagavatam and the Ramayana describe how nicely he greeted different individuals. To his elders, like his mother and father, he bowed low, he touched their feet. To friends, he shook hands and embraced, or he returned their obeisances. Younger friends touched his feet, and he offered his blessings. To children, he offered his love, and so on. So nice. Nothing wrong. So similarly with devotees also. If we know how to interact with different kinds of devotees appropriately, then everyone feels valued, and everyone feels cared for, and everyone feels secure, because they feel comfortable in knowing how things are supposed to work and how people are supposed to relate. And therefore, everyone can advance also. It's beneficial, mutually beneficial. Then the last, not the last, but the last point for this purpose here of association that Rupa Goswami makes after that. He says he devotes a special verse to describing the pure devotee. That last, the third of the three categories, the one you should serve and offer your obeisances to, render service to in a personal way. And he makes a very important point in that we should never judge a devotee based on his or her physical situation. Whether it be their birth, whether it be the state of their body, whether it's healthy or diseased, whether it be looks or beauty or anything, anything that has to be to do with the body, a devotee should never be judged like this. Because if we do, we'll miss most of the pure devotees in this world. We'll go through our whole life looking for that perfect pure devotee, and we'll miss it. Because devotional service is fundamentally something that is not tied or bound down to any material situation. Sometimes we wonder, for example, why is it that devotees pass away in circumstances that in our minds seem less than ideal? After Tamalakrishna Maharaj left this world, many devotees were asking, feeling, why would Krishna put a devotee through an accident like that? Which would seem like a horrific. Why not, comfortably in a bed in Vrindavan, surrounded by devotees chanting the holy names with time to prepare? Why this sudden, apparently untimely passing away? Why would Krishna put a devotee through a form of cancer that is apparently so painful and wastes the body away? No, that's the point Rupa Goswami is making here. That the devotee's physical circumstance has nothing to do, take away in any way from their position as devotees. If anything, it only enhances the reality, the validity of their being devotees. The fact that they're able to go through that circumstance in a Krishna conscious way is in fact one wonderful way in which Krishna shows that this person is actually someone who's worthy of service. That they're able to take on that kind of physical discomfort and still maintain their focus on Krishna. That's the virtue of a devotee. And you see example after example of this, both in contemporary ISKCON as well as in Shastra. So he's making this point quite emphatically with a beautiful example of the Ganga, of the Ganges. That even if the Ganga looks dirty, a pilgrim will still take a bath in the Ganges. Because it's pure. It cannot be contaminated by anything material. I mean, there are contaminants in the Ganga if you do a chemical measurement. But the spiritual potency of the Ganga is not eliminated by that. In the same way, a devotee's body can have problems, like physical deformities or disease or whatever. Even some kind of mental illness that makes the devotee seem unusual. Because even the mind is material. Right? Even the mind is a material object. It's a physical thing. So if the mind goes bad, so what? The consciousness, the heart, the intelligence is fixed in the right place. Krishna says, Apichet sudurācāro bhajate māma ananyabha sraghuriva samantabhya. Samyakya vasitovita, because his consciousness is samyak, is properly situated. Just like one time I was at an initiation ceremony being done by Sridhar Swami, who passed away a few years ago. And he was going through a physical condition, fighting a disease. And he said at the initiation, and this was one of the last few initiations he did, on a larger scale. And he was very thoughtful, very reflective. He said, you know, because of my disease, I have an extra buildup of ammonia gas in my brain. That somehow the body was releasing or unable to get rid of some kind of chemical that was collecting up here. And as a result, my reasoning process gets all cloudy at times. Like if you were trying to do a mathematical formula or deduction, A, B, C, D, like that. I can't. And he said, actually, I see this as a great blessing from Krishna, because it has forced me to reach out to Krishna more from the level of my heart, more from inside here. That I've come to realize or understand that I'm not even my mind. Why should we be our mind any more than we are this body? Since Kammano Bhutire, which is still one of the eight material elements that have nothing to do with the spiritual, the material mind. So I've had to reach out to Krishna to see things, to even decide things. He said to guide his disciples from here rather than from up here. So such a wonderful blessing. But if one were to judge a devotee based on his ability or her ability to make fine deductions and strict steps of reasoning and argument and keep things straight, then again, we miss out on wonderful devotees whose association we can learn from. And that's the best thing that could, that's the least worst that could happen. And possibly we might even commit offenses because our disrespect would manifest in some way, or disregard. So this is kind of a profile of association. Such a beautiful way in which Rupa Goswami describes what Sangha means, what association means, what it consists of. We can come to a temple for years and still get very little association, because we're not engaging in any of the activities of association. We get some, of course, because devotees are very kind and they'll engage us, even if we're not trying. But we have to strive for sangha, for association. And that's something we have to strive for. It's not just a matter of being at the right place at the right time. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's personal assistant on his South Indian tour, who was with him on a day-to-day basis, serving his needs physically, he fell into Maya. Right next to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So many people were right next to Krishna. Duryodhana was right there. He was Krishna's cousin, God's cousin, and knew of him from his childhood. Did he get much of Krishna's association? Well, he did, in a way. Right? But how much benefit did he get? In the end, he was killed by Krishna. That was his greatest benefit. But the point is, association is something we have to strive for. We have to seek out. It's not something that just is a matter of proximity. Right? And that goes back to the point of the ant and Ramachandra Prabhu, or the fly and the elephant. It's not just the scriptures say the crows and the dogs, they come and they take a bath in the Ganga every single day. Just like all the other pilgrims. But what are they getting from that? No, because they're taking their Tirtha Yatra as just a matter of taking a dip. And where is the Sangha? Tirthi Purvanti Tirthani, the Bhagavatam says. What makes the Tirtha an actual place of pilgrimage is the fact that you go there to take association of the devotees who are present there. And how does that association come? We have to seek it out. We have to look for it. Just going And just being in the proximity, yes, it's beneficial, but we can do so much better than that if we seek out that association. So that's the whole point of this analysis, is to understand what association is so we can maximize it. One time when I was going through this time in Kentucky on my own, I asked my Guru Maharaj, I said, Maharaj, I get so weak when I'm on my own. How do I fix that? How do I solve it? And at first Maharaj said, well, you can try to maintain a schedule that helps. And he gave different tips. And then the next day he came back and said, you know, you asked me that question. Actually, there's only one answer. Don't be alone.
Don't be alone.
Find some means of getting association. Because that's what will make your spiritual life. It's not a question of how strong you are or how well you use your techniques. You know, find association. If it's not possible in physical, it's okay. Find it in sound. Hear. At every moment, what's the sound vibration coming into our ears? What are we listening to? Because that will create our consciousness. Are we taking every free moment to read Prabhupada's books? To listen to classes by Srila Prabhupada? Are we taking that opportunity to associate with the pure devotee through Vani, through sound? Or not? That's the question. That's what will determine our success in spiritual life. So, any questions at this point? This is a very broad subject, but I want to leave a little time for questions. Yes, please.
Yeah, you mentioned the association with non-devotees, like at workplace or at friends who are not devotees. Sometimes to keep friendship, you have to, you know, and do those exchanges. And sometimes you do it willingly for preaching purposes. So, what's the say on it?
Yeah, see, that's a very good question. Sometimes it happens that at work, in order to maintain the obligations of work, you have to, for example, go out for lunch. Lunch business meetings are very common. In my own area, professors always gather over a meal, or you get invited out, the department has an event or something like that. Or you're interviewing a candidate for a new professor's job, and you have to take the candidate out for dinner. It's a required part of what you do in situations like that. There's different ways, different techniques of kind of offering association and reducing the amount we get in return. One way, for example, is something I try to do is if we're going out for lunch or dinner, I'll try to call the restaurant in advance and say, look, I have special dietary requirements, which are too complicated and difficult to explain. Perhaps you could make a plate of fresh cut fruit for me. When there's no cooking, no fire involved, especially with grains, then that helps a lot. Because fresh fruit, we can accept when it drops off a tree, when someone offers us like that. You'll see devotees often go to home, they accept food, they accept water and drink. So, and usually what will happen is that the restaurant, they'll feel so bad about the fact that you're just eating fruits, especially if it's a good restaurant, they'll go make an extra endeavor to make that plate especially beautiful. And it'll be decorated with grapes and watermelon and pineapples, and there'll be no apples and bananas in sight, just all kinds of all decorated in a beautiful way, and a strawberry in the middle and like that. And they bring it to the table, and literally everyone at the table goes, wow, someone back in the kitchen really likes you, huh? it's just fresh fruit. Would you like some? I mean, it's nothing. But people are, it's like, okay. It's very important to be consistent about this and to be clear about it from the start. See, what happens is we start and we become a little lax, and then one day we want to try to do it, and everyone goes, well, last week you ate at the restaurant. What's the problem today? Right? Or was it that it was his house that was okay and my house that was a problem?
Right.
Right? So it's that type of thing. But if you, in especially in a work environment, if you let people know in advance that usually what I try to tell them is say, see, I'm a Vaishnava, which means I have I'm a strict vegetarian. And what strictness means in my case, what vegetarianism means, is I try to avoid food that is cooked in a kitchen that also cooks meat. That's cooked. So it's kind of like kosher laws, where you can't mix a kitchen that cooks meat, anything in that kitchen cannot cook anything with dairy. Okay, so you have to have literally two separate kitchens. So I don't eat anything that's cooked in a kitchen that cooks meat. So immediately, it's like, okay, they start going, oh, okay, well, you know, and then, okay, maybe a vegetarian restaurant or a vegan restaurant automatically becomes easier. You can go there and you can order a bowl of fresh fruit. They'll always have it. They'll have a green salad, for example. You see what I mean?
Right.
Or if you go to even a meat restaurant, if you have to, you can order that and no one asks any questions. Because otherwise, if you just say, oh, I'm a vegetarian, they say, okay, we can go to, you know, this restaurant has a vegetarian option. And you say, well, I also don't eat onions and garlic. They say, okay, why don't you come to my home? I'll host you for dinner. And I'll make sure I put no onions and garlic. You see what I mean? So it becomes, that explanation seems to work very well.
Okay.
And it's not just an explanation, it's the actual fact.
Right.
This is what we try. Is to avoid cross-contamination like that. And often what can work nicely is that some kind of like office events, like potlucks and things like that, we can offer to bring something. You know, I have these requirements, but it's not a problem. Don't feel bad about me. I'm used to doing this. I love salads. And in fact, can I bring something too? And that way I can have it and all of you. And they're usually very happy to have that. You bring a nice pot of pilau or rice or something, some one pot dish, you know, that you can fill up on and it looks like your plate is full and they can enjoy and they're also receiving some prasad. Bring a plate of cookies to the holiday, you know, dinner or something like that. So there's nice ways of giving your association. And at that point, then eventually someone may come to a point where you can openly take their association also. So it's just a process of trying. We have to, sometimes it will be a struggle. There were times when my father was traveling for work and he'd go for 3 weeks to like Hong Kong and Japan or someplace, couldn't find any association of devotees or work was 2 hours away from where the temple was, and food from home would last for a week and then it would run out, and literally he'd survive on dates and carrots and stuff like that for a week. And it was a big austerity. But you feel good at the end. You feel like, okay, you know, I did something for Krishna. I've got a relationship with Krishna and I stuck to it. I kept my commitment. And when you, first time, if you do, after a while, eat improperly cooked food for the first time, you'll notice the change of consciousness immediately. Immediately you notice it. And you, if you're doing it every day, you won't notice it. But first time it happens, you realize, okay, it makes a difference. Yes,
Prabhupada? You said that a person should associate with pure devotees, like should take their association and serve them. And also it says that Guhyam Akhyati Prakshati. So, is it that we should always try to find someone who is really pure devotee and then be very confidential to him only?
No. These exchanges are true for with any devotee. The question of the different types of devotees was only in terms of the degree of respect or the degree of intensity of service that needs to be there. And how much care we should take to try to seek out doing that service. But in terms of these six exchanges of love, they should occur with any devotee. Not just with any devotee, Prabhupada says with any human being, if you want a relationship, you're going to have to go through these six things.
So, but this association, Sangha, how does it work out? Like, in next verse you said that we should associate with pure devotees.
we should associate with everyone. We should associate with devotees. That's the point. And when you find a pure devotee, do some extra service with them. But association with devotees, every devotee is wonderful to associate with. That's actually one of the things that you realize about Krishna consciousness. That my job often takes me in a lot of kind of elite cultured circles in society, places which are considered to be very polished, upstanding, and cultured citizens in very high-class society, people who consider themselves very learned and very so forth. And it's nice in a way, it's sophisticated, it's good feeling. But very quickly you realize that there's nothing like the association of devotees. Even the association of the simplest, newest bhakta in the temple is so much more satisfying than the most elevated, educated, sophisticated person in the material world. Why? Not because there's anything wrong with them, but because Krishna's missing from the picture, you see? Krishna's missing. And with even the newest of devotees, even just an innocent person who comes to the temple, you can sit and have a conversation with Krishna. And even with the most sophisticated person in this material world, it's so difficult talking about Krishna. It's so difficult. You have to bring him in this way, and that way, and this excuse, and that excuse, and my son's name is Krishna, and you know what that means, and it's, we should do it. This is preaching, right? But it's a struggle. And with a devotee, simple as it is, so easy. Very simple, straightforward. Sit down and talk about Krishna. And there's never, you never have to talk about the weather. Have you noticed? With non-devotees, you always have to talk about the weather. There's nothing to talk about. Right? With devotees, you never have to talk about the weather. Because there's so many other wonderful things to talk about, like Krishna. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I've heard it said from time to time that we shouldn't be judgmental. Mm-hmm. And yet, in these verses, Rupa Goswami is advising us to judge the attention.
Right. That's a very nice question. We should not be judgmental.
What's the
question? Often it's said that we should not be judgmental, and yet at the same time it seems that Rupa Goswami is asking us to make judgments about different types of individuals and devotees. You see, okay. This is how I try to understand it, and please add to this in any way you like. But there's a difference between making judgments and making distinctions. So making distinctions is a natural facet of life in this world. We have to make distinctions. But the problem with being judgmental involves when we use those distinctions as a way to put someone else down and to make ourselves superior to them. So, for example, if I make a judgment that this person in my class is a student, and he's not that great of a student. He's not a top performer. He needs help. Now, I need to make that judgment or distinction in order to help that student. But if my intent is, this student is not doing well, so I have to have a meeting with this student in order to see how I can help him improve, then that's not being judgmental. That's using that distinction for the benefit of the other individual. Whereas if I were to go and say, clearly, I know so much more than that guy, right? And clearly that person is worth nothing, and write down, you're a loser on his mark sheet, then that's, I'm using that to put that person down. Of course, in a student-teacher relationship, it's a little different, but perhaps you could think of it in terms of colleagues. That I meet a colleague at a conference who's a professor in a different university. That person clearly knows less about a subject than I do. I can use that conscious awareness, which is inevitable, that distinction I made, to either help that person, to encourage them to come up and to sharpen their understanding. Yeah, that's a good point you made. But you might also look at it from this perspective also. Oh, yeah, okay. Or I can use it to make sure that person realizes how little he knows and how much more I know, which is so often the case in the material world. So when we make distinctions of higher and equal and lower, the proper response from the higher is, let me learn, let me serve. The proper response with the equal is, let me create friendship. And the proper response for the junior is, How can I help this person in a compassionate and generous manner? Unfortunately, what happens often in the mature world, which is in fact what being judgmental is all about, is for the junior we say, this person is less than me, how can I make sure this person knows that fact? Right? For the person who's equal, this person is equal to me, how can I push him down so that he's no longer equal to me, and I am in fact his superior? And this person is superior to me, how can I pull him down? This is the definition of envy. This is what. So when distinctions are combined with envy, they become judgmentalism in a negative sense. But when distinctions are combined with a proper response that is marked by compassion, generosity of heart, then there's nothing wrong with that distinction. So what he's describing here is a distinction, and then he's describing the proper response to each distinction. And therefore, it wouldn't come in that category of being judgmental in a negative sense. Is that okay? Yeah. Okay. Farooq, and then Mahdi.
Yeah. So it seems that it's pretty straightforward, especially in America. It seems that people who are pretty sensitive to even the dietary requirements that you say, you know, they either think you're a little weird, but they'll allow you to do it if you want.
Right.
But how do you deal with it if, say, you're in a family situation, and you somehow have had the opportunity to absorb some of the knowledge and say that, okay, you want to put it in practice, but then you're put up against a situation where, you know, you go home, and you talk to your mom and dad, and no, I don't need anything to call you. They look at you and they're like, you are completely in practice.
Right.
You know, I know so many people who need anything to call, and they're just fine with it. Are you telling me that, you know, people that do not even well aren't going to be, what kind of judgment are you making? I find that family members seem to have a lot more power than office members.
Definitely. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Family members, our best and worst moments in spiritual life come from family. We can get an immense amount of support in Krishna consciousness. We can have an immense amount of challenge as well. So that's very much a fact. And all I can say is that we have to deal with the situation with immense sensitivity and yet plenty of determination. Because it's true, often parents will be very disturbed, even hurt. I mean, forget onions and garlic, even if we refuse to eat meat. And we've grown up eating their food. And they fed, and they're like, now you're too good for me. I fed you when you were in diapers. Right? And you've been eating this stuff your whole life. And now all of a sudden you're some kind of sure. It's very difficult. It's naturally very difficult for parents and other family members to wrap their heads around something like that. But it's also true with family members that it's very rare that they'll give up on you. Sometimes they will, but usually not just because of spiritual things. In other words, they almost always come around. The pain will be much greater than explaining it to your office members. But in the end, you'll make supporters out of them. Because you see, the thing with parents, the nature of parents, is that in the end, you're their child, right? And they love you, and they're not going to give up that relationship in any way, nor are you going to give up that relationship. It's their right to fight it out. It's their right to argue with you. It's their right to tell you off. But in the end, they're going to go along with it. And this is true with so many devoted families I know. That, yes, it took some time, it took some determination. There were a few sore spots. But now, the mother's a vegetarian, or she's given up onions and garlic, and just dad is holding out, right?
Yes.
So it happens, it comes, you know, but where are they going to go other than their children? Right? Where are they going to go? This is the world, right? For parents, children are their world. Even more than parents are the world for children, because as parents grow older, they look towards their children more and more, whereas as children grow older, they... Yeah, they have a tendency to move away. So it will come around. Yes, the other way.
This last Monday there was an initiation in Chalpati. Try to go up in that temple where 46, I believe, parents of brahmacharis became initiated.
Wow! 46 parents of brahmacharis. Wow. And you know, a lot of those brahmacharis went through a lot with their parents. Went through a lot. Because if you think giving up onions and garlic is difficult with parents, imagine giving up full-blown careers and full educations to join an ashram and live a life like a beggar. I mean, for parents of any kind, Indian or Western, that's very difficult. You invest so much money in your children and so much effort and endeavor, and you hope they'll one day turn out to be successful people and big in this world and so forth, and they end up joining an ashram and living in a room with 10 other people and on the floor with a mat. It's difficult for parents to see. And a lot of these brahmacharis have gone through a lot. And so to hear something like that is just evidence of one time, who was it? Was it Ramananda Prabhu's parents who came to see Prabhupada? And they were really upset at at their child becoming a devotee. And Prabhupada handled it so tactfully because the parents were really upset, and when the parents showed up, Prabhupada, of all things he could do, he turned around and asked them for a donation to support the movement. The parents were like, and I think it was the father who immediately said, I've already given you my son, and you want my money too now? And Prabhupada said, thank you very much. He said, I've given you my son. And Prabhupada said, thank you very much. So, and of course, Prabhupada had a way of winning the hearts of parents. It can be done. Right? It's a matter of how sensitive, how tactful, how pure in heart we are. Sometimes devotees approach it in kind of a crusade-type manner. You know, they're meat eaters now, I'll never talk to them ever again till they quit, and anyway, I'm not supposed to associate with non-devotees, that's what I heard in the seminar today, and so I'm not coming, and this kind of fanatical approach, naturally, then it takes a long time, and sometimes it doesn't heal. But one of the nice things about brahmacharis and the way they're trained today is, you know, no, okay, keep in touch. Let them know that you'll always be their son, you always love them, and you visit, you go to their home, and it's a different kind of relationship. And it has to be treated in a very special way, because it's also a lot of respect associated with that relationship, where you can turn away someone because I don't want to associate with you. You can't do that with parents, no matter how fallen they might be. In one particular way. But you can't see them that way, because in fact it says in the Shastras that a sannyasi, after taking sannyas, no matter who he meets, doesn't have to bow to anyone. Even if he meets someone who's much senior to him, and the sannyasi is a young man, he doesn't have to bow to them. He doesn't have to bow to anyone, except for parents. But when he meets his own parents, he should pay full dandavas. And acharyas across history have shown this by their example. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself. So it's something that has to be dealt with very, very carefully in a very appreciative manner, because the debt we owe to our parents, right, it can never be repaid. It can never be repaid. And by becoming devotees, our goal should be to help them, not to reject them. It doesn't make us superior to them. It just is one way in which we can actually help them by becoming devotees. Because once there's a devotee in the family, the entire family becomes very auspicious. So I see several hands up, but I don't want to take this time too much longer, especially because we have a cultural presentation coming up, and we have to give due time to the devotees who have come to do that. So I want to stop here, pause here. A couple things. One is just a little preview for tomorrow. We have one more session tomorrow. What are the times?
10 to 12.
Tomorrow morning. And that session will be dealing with the later verses of Nectar of Instruction. And specifically, we'll talk about different types of devotees in terms of relationships with Krishna. And I'll try to focus on Srimati Radharani a little bit. And so the tone will be a little different. It'll be less kind of practice-oriented and more in terms of glorification of the Lord's very advanced devotees, because that's the subject of the last few verses. So that's going to be the topic for the next couple of, for the last 2 hours of the presentation tomorrow. Please come if you can. For today, I just want to thank the devotees here at the Washington Temple for all their facilitation and help in terms of venue and in terms of prasad. And I also want to thank His Grace Nilamani Guru for all the effort he's placed in organizing the seminar and getting everyone here. He's really been thinking about this, working hard, and I'm very grateful to him for engaging both of us in this way and providing this association to us. So thank you to him.